I speak to you in the name of a living and loving God, revealed in creation as a Redeemer and as an indwelling Spirit. Amen. Today is Gaudete Sunday. If you're a Latin scholar, the literal translation of that is, you rejoice. Well, I know there are moments in our lives when if someone were to come up to us, to me, and tell me to rejoice, I'd think, well, where do you get off? I don't feel like rejoicing right now. I had to pay a whole bunch of money to fix the brakes in my car. My wife has the flu. My children are in trouble. I've been looking at the news, and I'm trying to go on a diet from the news. So what's to rejoice about? Quite often, you and I, members of the family of the living and redeeming and resurrected God, are sneered at by society. They look at us and they say, how can you be joyful? Look at what's going on around you. Are you naive? Are you crazy? What's to be joyful about? Well, I don't have a comeback for that, other than to be rejoiceful. We lit the pink candle today. The pink candle is symbolic of the shepherd's and Mary's joy. Those of you who know about Advent wreaths realize that it's a circular symbol, God's never-ending eternal love for us. Never ends. Always there. And so the candles, there's a candle for hope. Heard about that last week. There's a candle for peace. We've heard about that. Today, there's a candle for joy. And next week will be the candle for love. And all of those qualities are grounded in a never-ending, eternal love God has for us and for creation. Now, I could end my sermon right there, and maybe some of you might wish I had. That's a reason to rejoice. Now, I never thought that I would have to do a sermon on the word joy, ever, because joy just is, right? It sort of washes over us. But I thought, well, I better do the job properly and find some kind of interpretation or explanation for the word joy. So I started thinking back to my time as a choir boy. If you can imagine Christmas Eve, Advent wreath, glorious music, choir boys poking each other, and we would wish each other Merry Christmas at the stroke of midnight and not before, because we were above all else theologians, and we knew that it had to be midnight before it was Christmas. The other thing we put up with choir boys were rough collars that were starched to a razor sharp edge. And no choir director ever had to tell us to keep our chins up, because if we didn't, we knew there was pain involved. That was joy. And I never had to describe the word. I just, along with everybody else with the glorious music and lights, embodied it. But today I'm going to take a crack at telling you what I think, or somebody thinks, the word joy means. For starters, it's a noun, just in case you wondered. And it's been rendered into a verb. Rejoice, enjoy. I'm sure you can think of all the times that joy has been used. Webster Dictionary says, joy is extreme pleasure or happiness. And I don't believe that goes anywhere near what joy is. And I'm not alone in that. So I kept looking, and I used that wonderful verb, Google, and I discovered another interpretation. Joy is an immeasurable, life-defining, transforming reservoir into which we can delve, waiting to be tapped into. Furthermore, joy requires ultimate surrender. Now, I think surrender has taken a bad rap through the ages. Nobody likes the idea of losing control. And yet, apparently, joy requires ultimate surrender. Furthermore, it is something that requires a choice. There's a decision to be made. Now, I had to wrap my mind around that one, too. What do you mean I have to decide whether to be joyful or not? I mean, are you just not joyful? I think of all the things that happen today in this world, both personally, in the community, globally. I did mention I was going on a news diet because that stuff can bring you down. Unless you've read anything by Viktor Frankl, who learned in a death camp that you can choose how you react to the stuff that's happening to you. Between what is happening and what you do is freedom. True freedom. In his book, the people that marched around the towers, keeping them in the concentration camp, had all the liberty in the world, but they were not free because they were scripted by a profane political system. But Frankl learned true freedom. And by his ministration, and by embodying that understanding, he is credited with saving many people's lives who may have otherwise given up. I think there's an element of joy to that. What does the scriptural record have to tell us? Or the psalm? Well, if you go back, give or take a couple of years, about 5,000. If you go back that length of time, you have just come back to your country. You were in captivity. Cyrus of Persia in the year 538, you can check your books if you want or if you've got a mobile device, overcame the Babylonian Empire, and as was their practice, they allowed all the people that had been subjugated to go home. So the people of Israel go home. You can only begin to imagine what they faced. They had been there, according to Jeremiah's calculations, and I'm not going to do a Bible study, but apparently so. They'd been there approximately 70 years. A whole generation had passed, and things had really got off the tracks. They arrived at a place where there was rubble. They arrived in a place where the whole social structure had disappeared. There was no rule of law. There was no security. If you look at Nehemiah and Ezra, the two books, you can get an absolute description of what they were faced with doing. They had to stand in the holes of the walls along the walls of Jerusalem to protect the people from raiders while they rebuilt the city. I often wonder what it's like to be in all the different places in the world right now that are in a state of total chaos and rubble. And so they faced an insurmountable task. How am I going to put all this back together? How will we possibly survive? How will I possibly pass that exam? How will I possibly find reconciliation with a relationship that's got off the tracks? How can I do this? The prophetic voice says to them, you're not alone. You don't have to do this by yourself. You don't have to be in control. You can actually surrender into the love of God, and by the power of that love and the encouragement of that love and the grounding in that divine presence, you'll be able to put it all back together. You'll be able to pass that exam. You will be able to find some reconciliation. You will be able to rebuild Jerusalem, and so on and so on, whatever your story is. That whole notion of having to be controlled, which absolutely ties us in knots, when you surrender into joy, it evaporates. And I'm not being naive. So what does the prophetic voice say? He starts off by using powerful words like rebuild, restore, strengthen. You'll be like oaks. You can take that home. I don't have this thing in front of me. I don't remember all those words. But they are all words of encouragement. And I think what the prophetic voice is saying is, if you act like it's okay, it will be okay. If you act like you're defeated, you will be defeated. I think that's not news to anybody in this room. If you let something bring you down, you'll go down. If you allow the presence, for our purposes, of a living, redeeming, loving God to flood into our lives, then there's a real chance that we can rejoice. The other part of that is that I smiled at somebody in Costco yesterday, and it's kind of funny because we're all sort of going about our business looking really serious and scrambling and getting all tied up in the minutiae of celebrating. Well, there was no celebration there, and I smiled at somebody. I don't know why, I just did. And their face broke into this most beatific smile, and that gave me joy. And I hope it gave them joy. And I hope they were able to navigate what was going on in the store, as was I. It's infectious. Joy is infectious. But you have to make a choice. And you have to surrender. Difficult concepts. But you have to. And what does Paul say to the Thessalonians? My best understanding is that Thessalonica was the second church he founded in Europe. It's a city, an ancient city, on the great Roman road along the Aegean Sea. And of course, it was a pretty important seaport too. So Paul finds himself there. And he experiences a lot of resistance to trying to give the good news. You know, you want to give somebody good news and they just don't want it. Have you ever been in that situation before? So he's giving them the good news, the gospel, the resurrection. And a small community picks up on that. But there's a funny little twist in the story about the Thessalonians. Some of the members of that community were so convinced that the second coming was imminent that they decided to be very passive with the news that they got. So they sat back and waited, and they didn't do anything with the good news they'd been given. Anyone familiar with that glorious bass, baritone, trumpet solo, "The Trumpet Shall Sound"? I'll spare you me singing it because I'm not a baritone. Somebody could. "The trumpet shall sound and the dead shall be raised incorruptible and we shall be saved." What Paul is saying to them is, look, people, yeah, there'll be people that die before the second coming, but they're not going to miss the boat. They'll be swept up in God's love too. And you just can't sit around doing nothing, thinking that it's all over. You have got to do something active. You have got to proclaim that gospel. And I love the way that was read this morning. Glorious. I could hear Paul. Rejoice! You know, the imperative. You, rejoice. Because when you rejoice, other people will be drawn to you, wonder what the circumstances are, and it opens the conversation. Well, why are you so joyful? Look at the garbage that's going on. I want to tell you something. God has redeemed the world. You are part of a sacred story, not just any story. You are part of a cosmic inbreaking. I could go on with modifiers. You're part of that. And that you need to share. And the fastest way to share that is to show the joy you feel that God really does love, really does create, really does redeem. Now, the word joy comes up a lot, especially in Christmas carols and in Easter carols. I can remember singing them as a choir boy. I loved that stuff. Especially around Easter and Christmas. Why? Well, Christmas, pretty obvious. God, the author, steps onto the stage of history and says, from this point onward, things will be okay, you're not alone, and I love you. The circular wreath, grounded in God's love. Joy is a result of being grounded in God's love. I always thought a preacher had to say something about the gospel. Some years earlier, I was told, now you make one point about one reading. Well, you're not going to get away with that, simply because the gospel is kind of interesting this morning, and it ties in very nicely with the whole notion of joy. It's sort of two things stuck together. I don't know why the liturgist put those things together. I can't blame the dean, because we don't choose the readings. There they are. So we start off in the middle of the prologue. And if you're here tonight, you'll hear that glorious prologue. It is cosmic in its dimension. In the beginning was the Word, and you know how it goes. And if you've ever sat on a Christmas Eve in a pew and the hair stands up on the back of your neck because you know that God intended to love and redeem the world right from the get-go. So we start off in the middle of that, the little bit about the messenger. And then all of a sudden, whoever put this together decides to jump ahead to the messenger. And it's the first time we meet John the Baptizer in the Gospel of John. And I like the interplay. I think it was at the Advent Carol service we sang Orlando Gibbons, The Record of John. Beautiful piece of music. Well done. Joy-inspiring. So John's there in the desert, not the kind of person you would invite to a cocktail party. Kind of hairy and messy and apparently ate locusts, although they're supposed to be nutritious. And the leaders go out and they want to know what this guy's all about. What are you on about? Are you the prophet? No. Well, you got to be Elijah. You know, Elijah was the one that's supposed to come back at the end of time. No, I'm not Elijah either. Well, what are you then? Why are you baptizing? Well, simply put, John says, you don't have to be afraid of me. I mean, people were always afraid of prophets, right? Because prophets are scary. They can upset the whole apple cart politically and so on. No, I'm not a prophet. But there is somebody in the crowd right now. And that somebody has the power to transform and turn on its head and straighten out God's purposes for creation. Not about me. It's about that person. And that's why I'm here. And that's why I'm full of joy. Because God has acted. And that's what we're about to celebrate in less than a week. God has stepped into history and acted out of a sense of enduring, never-ending love for us. I don't know if you feel like you're loved. Let me tell you, you are. What I'd like to leave you with is my wish that all of you here and all of you whom you know and whose lives you touch will truly tap into that reservoir, that unending, life-defining, transforming reservoir called joy, in the knowledge that God truly loves you. Take it out. Tell other people to rejoice. Maybe they'll catch it. Amen.
Amen.